Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in December of 2018.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In his book, Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter, writer Ben Goldfarb says beavers are environmental Swiss Army knives, capable of tackling just about any ecological dilemma. Trying to slow down floods or filter out pollution? There's a beaver for that. Helping to capture more water for agriculture in the face of climate change? Add a beaver. Concerned about erosion, salmon runs, or wildfire? Take two beaver families and check back in a year. Ben Goldfarb says Eager is the story of how nature's most ingenious architects shape our world and how they can help save it. Ben Goldfarb is an award-winning environmental journalist who covers wildlife management and conservation biology. His work has been featured in Science, Mother Jones, The Guardian, High Country News, Vice, Audubon Magazine, and many other publications. And he holds a Master of Environmental Management degree from Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And Ben Goldfarb, you were telling me before we went on the air, you live in Spokane these days.
I do live in Spokane. Yeah, a pretty beavery place. You know, we've got beavers all up and down the Spokane River.
All right. Where are you from originally?
I grew up in New York.
New York. Okay. Yeah. All right.
So lived out west for a while.
Now this is a Western prejudice, so you wouldn't obviously get into nature in New York, but I guess it depends on where you are.
Yeah, you know, we have up in upstate New York in the Adirondack Mountains, we've got some of the country's most robust beaver populations, as well as black bears and coyotes and you name it. You know, New York is much wilder than I think most people give it credit for.
Yeah, and especially out west, we have this, you know, it's stereotype probably of back east. So tell me how you got into beavers, how you became, I guess you call yourself beaver believers.
that's right, yeah. So, you know, I think like most people who spend a lot of time hiking and camping and fishing, you know, I'd certainly had some beaver encounters and always had a kind of a baseline appreciation for these very nifty animals. But I didn't quite understand beavers as these world-changing forces of nature until a few years ago. I was at a conference in Seattle, a beaver conference, you know, the biologists there were just created this portrait of beavers as these amazing landscape scale architects capable of storing immense amounts of water behind their dams and engineering incredible quantities of wildlife habitat. And it was really spending time with these scientists who have studied beavers all their lives that helped me realize just how profoundly important these animals really are.
I love to see in the book you're scribbling on napkins because you forgot to bring your notebook, I guess.
Right, that's right.
Everybody in the room is fitting the stereotype, they're running wearing flannel. You paint the picture very well. Before we get to the beavers, I want to paint the picture of the humans. So this group of beaver believers includes not only scientists, but hairdressers and...
Yeah, and real estate agents and former physician's assistants. I mean, it's one of the amazing things about beavers, I think, is, you know, the way they just have this ability to sort of drag people into their orbit. You know, I think that, you know, in part because they're such visible forces on the landscape, you know, they're really fun and interesting animals to interact with. You know, you can visit a beaver colony and think about them and study them in this really compelling way that's hard to achieve with other species, because other species just don't have the same highly visible impact that beavers do. So it's just fascinating to me how all of these people from very disparate walks of lives have kind of become beaver believers and have devoted their lives to promoting the conservation and restoration of this animal. It's pretty cool.
You quote one lady in the book who became a beaver believer, and then her family, she jokes, thinks she's going through a midlife crisis.
Right.
Why are you into beavers?
Yeah.
They tell her.
Yeah, exactly. And that's Sharna Gilmore, she's a former real estate agent up in California, and she's another person who sort of succumbed to the incredibly compelling beaver story.
So in brief, and we'll get into this, of course, in depth during the hour, why beavers? As you write in the book, there might be a group of weasel believers out there, but you haven't heard of them. You doubt it, right?
Yeah. If there are any out there, they can call into this show. I'd be curious.
Well, with the beaver believers against the weasel believers, what is it about beavers?
Yeah, you know, they're truly unique in their landscape architecture and engineering, right? I mean, there's really no other animal that does what beavers do. Of course, they build dams, they create these incredible ponds and wetlands. They're holding back enormous volumes of water behind their dams, and they're basically just engineering these habitats. You know, beavers are what scientists call a keystone species. So just as in architecture, you know, the keystone is kind of the block at the top of a stone arch that holds up the entire ecosystem, beavers are also, by engineering these watery habitats that are so important to life in the West, they're also supporting these vast ecosystems as well. You know, you've got, I mean, it's almost impossible to name a species that doesn't benefit from beavers in some way. You know, you've got the waterfowl that nest and forage in beaver ponds. You've got the amphibians that breed there. You know, you've got the juvenile trout and salmon that that rely on those slow water habitats for refuge. You know, the number of creatures that fall under the beaver umbrella is just so vast, and beavers are really unique in that way.
So let's pause here to describe the beaver. Of course, we all have a vague idea. It's, you know, it's a furry animal with the prominent teeth and the big tail.
Right.
Beaver is a rodent.
Yeah, they're North America's largest rodent. I think they're bigger than most people expect. You know, a large adult beaver is, you know, 65 pounds or so. Even, you know, a mid-sized one is 40 to 50 pounds. So, you know, as big as many dogs. You know, I think that we usually see them swimming half submerged, so we don't quite realize how hefty they are. But they're pretty dense balls of fur and fat and muscle.
Well, I had this question. I felt a little foolish, but I'm guessing part of our audience has this question too. Are beavers dangerous in any way? Will they attack you with their big teeth?
Yeah, generally not. They're usually pretty shy and retiring. They'll usually, you know, slap their tail and swim off if you startle them. But there is one known beaver-caused human fatality, which was a fisherman in Belarus who tried to take a selfie with a beaver, and the beaver bit him in the thigh and severed an artery. So no beaver selfies, I think, is a pretty good rule of thumb.
All right, dude, keep a bit of distance. But,
yeah.
because as you write in the book, you know, beaver people who do beaver relocation, you know, you'd obviously have to pick up the beaver and...
Yeah, there are people handling beavers for sure, but you know, but I think that most of the people who do that for a living take pretty good precautions. You know, mm-hmm. They keep them in a sack or a trap generally, so they're not they're not doing too much beaver cuddling ideally.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's interesting. You say the beavers are located at a junction point for ecological development. They affect many other species. One of those is the trumpeter swan.
Right.
And so you talk with a gentleman up in Jackson Hole area. His focus is on the swans, but to get a higher swan population, you need to increase the beaver population.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the reason for that is that swans prefer to nest on islands, essentially. You know, they like these platforms out in the middle of the water, because that's where you can, you know, raise your chicks safe from predators like foxes and coyotes. So, you know, what's a perfect swan nesting platform? Well, I mean, an island beaver lodge really is a good nesting area. Plus, beavers are also creating these ponds that grow the aquatic vegetation that swans need to feed. So beavers are really engineering this fantastic swan habitat, and that's just one of the many species that are really benefiting from these incredible animals.
Mm. In the book, you paint a vivid picture of life before humans, when the beavers, I guess, ruled North America in a way. I wonder if you could do that for us, that were, you know, the I guess, many, many wetlands. You know, I don't know what the beaver population was, but in the millions?
Yeah, probably in the hundreds of millions. You know, we don't have a great historic beaver population estimate, but, you know, 400 million is what one naturalist has thrown out. And, you know, and all of those beavers would have engineered hundreds of millions of acres of pond and wetland habitat. You know, there's no question that North America was once much wetter and lusher and more pond and wetland covered than it is today. You know, you read these old trappers and explorers journals, you know, and I mean, one explorer describes crossing the state of Indiana, which today is, you know, is cornfields, and couldn't find a dry place to camp for 100 miles because beavers had so thoroughly marshed it up. You know, it's, I mean, I think that a lot of the places that we consider desert today, including the Southwest, were much wetter and lusher, and that was in large measure thanks to beavers.
So many areas, for example, streams, you're used to standing on rocks, right?
Right.
Pebbles, sand. What would you be experiencing with more beavers?
Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of people have this conception of a stream as this, you know, as this kind of single thread, straight line moving through the landscape with a rocky bottom and you know, cold, clear, free-flowing, fast-moving water. And, you know, certainly some streams would have looked like that. But I think that in many places, you know, these beaver impoundments were much more the rule than the exception. You know, so instead of that clear, fast, free-flowing stream, you would have seen, you know, these slow, murky, backed-up swamps, and you know, you would have seen much more complex habitat in a lot of ways. You know, many different channels created by beavers moving across the landscape. You know, these really wet, inundated floodplains. I think we would have seen less free-flowing streams and more sort of slow-moving, backed-up, multi-channel marsh-type habitats or wetland habitats.
Of course, you know, some people maybe prefer the cool, you know, fast-flowing stream.
Sure.
You know, in the book you say we humans are fanatical over micromanagers of the natural world.
Right. You know, we love to develop in the exact same places that beavers call habitat, right? Both our species, we love these low gradient valley bottoms with really fertile floodplains. You know, that's where we built our roads and our farms and our towns and our subdivisions is in exactly the same places that beavers love to engineer. So, you know, it's no wonder that beaver and human conflicts are a pretty frequent occurrence in many places.
Mm-hmm. And I guess going against that regimentation that I think we like as humans, beaver habitat in all its glory can seem pretty chaotic.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you walk into a beaver impoundment, you know, and there are dead and dying trees everywhere. You know, the ground is pretty spongy and soft, and there are side channels and offshoots, you know, branching off everywhere, right? It's this very wet, complex ecosystem that, you know, doesn't conform to our sort of traditional standards of natural beauty. You know, you're not going to open up, a copy of Field and Stream magazine and, you know, and see a crazy beaver wetland in it. You know, you're going to see that straight single thread stream. But, you know, again, I mean, these kinds of complex habitats are so important because there are just so many different niches in them, right? I mean, those dead trees are fantastic habitat for woodpeckers. You know, all of those little shallow side channels, you know, are wonderful boreal toad breeding areas. You know, there's just that those kinds of complex habitats may not cohere with our conception of what a stream should look like, but for so many species, they're incredibly vital.
You quote Norman McLean, "River Runs Through It,"
right?
Which you know, I guess maybe from the movie, from reading the books, or the book, I associate Norman McLean with that clear, fast-running stream.
Yeah,
tell us about his comment about the beaver habitat.
Right. Yeah, he's got a great line, and a river runs through it. You know, where the brothers and some of their friends and family are going fishing, and you know, one of the guys goes off to fish in a beaver area and describes, you know, falling through these loose piles of sticks and ending up with a kind of a wreath of seaweed around his neck and coming home with a basket full of fish. You know, I think that captures the kind of the challenges and joys of fishing in beaver ponds pretty well. You know, I do a lot of fly fishing myself, and you know, beaver ponds, they're tough places to fish a lot of the time, right? The vegetation is pretty dense. You know, the water, the ground is kind of, it's pretty sludgy, right? There's lots of sediment accumulated at the bottom of the pond, so you end up, you know, sinking in up to your shins. So, you know, they're not, you know, they're tough places to fish. But again, I mean, those, you know, those deep, cold ponds that beavers create are fantastic fish refuges. And, you know, certainly the number of fishermen I've talked to who you know, recall growing up fishing in their beaver pond, and, you know, that's where they caught the biggest trout. You know, everybody has that kind of story.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to hear a little bit more about beaver behavior, beaver biology. And we'll talk about the effects. I want to hear about this. You call them the Swiss Army knife of the ecological world. You talk about, you know, if you have floods, if you are concerned about water quality, if you want more water for agriculture, perhaps you're concerned about wildfire. We've had these devastating wildfires in California. I want to hear about all of that and more. The book is Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. More following this break.
Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in December of 2018.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. We're talking about beavers today. You might wonder, well, that's a kind of a narrow topic, isn't it? Spending a whole hour on beavers? What's up? The book is Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. So let me push off beaver biology. I want to tackle this question head on here. So you do a pretty good sales job here. You describe yourself as a beaver believer yourself, right?
Yep.
So beavers are the environmental Swiss Army knives, capable of tackling just about any ecological dilemma. This is quoting Ben Goldfarb, my guest. Trying to slow down floods or filter out pollution? There's a beaver for that. Hoping to capture more water for agriculture in the face of climate change? Add a beaver. Concerned about erosion, salmon runs, or wildfire? Take two beaver families and check back in a year. And someone listening to that might say, are you overselling this? So I wonder, maybe you can counter that. Tell us a little bit about
it. Yeah, I've definitely had that accusation leveled at me. But, you know, I think that all of those claims are heavily backed up by peer-reviewed research. You know, I mean, take one of those claims that beavers are good at filtering out pollution. You know, we know that these beaver ponds and wetlands, by slowing down the flow of water, basically cause sediment to settle out. And as that sediment settles out, it's all, you know, you're also settling out nitrogen and phosphorus and, you know, all of these sort of, you know, fertilizer, these chemical fertilizers that, you know, that are sprayed in our fields and end up, you know, in our watersheds and can be very deleterious. You know, we're basically causing that pollution to settle out. And there have been lots of studies showing that, you know, that beavers are these fantastic capturers of nitrates and phosphorus and thus improve downstream water quality. You know, the notion that beavers are good at capturing water for agriculture, you know, that's been shown many times as well, right? That by slowing down the flow of water, you know, you're ensuring that there's still water in streams and rivers and irrigation ditches into the summer and fall, into the hot season. You know, you often hear about farmers and ranchers complaining that beavers are stealing their water, but beavers aren't stealing the water. They're just slowing that water down. And again, they're basically prolonging the duration of time in which that water is available to users. So, you know, all of these claims about beavers sort of about all of their benefits. You know, when I started reporting the book, I also thought that stuff was overblown. But then you read the peer-reviewed published science, and it's clear that these are incredibly valuable, useful animals.
Mm. What about wildfires? Of course, you know, much in our minds. The wildfire season this year seems to get longer and longer. It seems to be almost year-round, at least in California these days. What about how do beavers affect wildfires?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's, you know, and that is one topic that I think that the science is just beginning to catch up. But, you know, anecdotally, it's incredibly powerful. You know, I saw pictures recently taken by Joe Wheaton, who's a scientist here at Utah State University. And, you know, he's gone out to fires, and the pictures are incredible because you see that, you know, the hill slopes are just completely blackened, and the only green, lush, wet place on the landscape is the incredibly beaver-influenced valley bottom. You know, the pictures are amazing because you just see, you know, again, black on the hillsides and green where beavers have remained. So the idea there is that, you know, is that beavers are creating these fantastic fire refugia or fire breaks that are slowing the spread of wildfire. And, you know, there are places in Washington where I live where you can see very clearly that, you know, one side of a valley is black and then the other side is green. And the reason, again, is that beavers basically prevented that wildfire from spreading from one hill slope to the other by creating this wet, lush fire break. Mm.
Another benefit I wouldn't have thought of, you mentioned the areas where beavers are, the aquifers get filled faster.
Yeah, absolutely. Beavers definitely raise groundwater tables. And the reason for that, you know, is when you look at a beaver pond, of course, there's all of the visible surface water you can see. But what you don't see is the weight of that pond, you know, sort of forcing water into the ground, you know, as water spreads out onto the floodplain, you know, it's infiltrating the soil and it's raising that water table, you know, it's saturating the earth. And of course, that's really good for vegetation production. You know, we know that in places that have beavers, you know, we just get so much more willow and aspen and cottonwood and grass production because beavers are basically acting as irrigators, you know, and there are lots of ranchers who for that reason have embraced beavers because beavers are actually increasing the forage for their cattle by sub-irrigating these meadows.
Mm. And this isn't only in North America, right? You went to England and Scotland.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So there are two species of beavers in the world. There's Castor canadensis, which is the North American beaver, and then there's Castor fiber, which is the Eurasian beaver. And you know they're very similar species. They have the same landscape impacts. And you know, in there, beavers were trapped out of the UK hundreds of years ago. They had been gone from Britain since the 1700s, and they've recently been reintroduced. And they're having incredible benefits. You know, the big problem there, or one of the big problems there, is flooding, right? It's a very rainy place, and there are these, you know, big destructive floods that you know sweep through farmland every winter in Britain. And what scientists have found there is that by basically slowing down that water, beavers can have real flood mitigation benefits. You know, one study basically found that, you know, you get a big sort of pulse of storm water rushing downstream, and it hits a beaver pond and wetland complex, and all of that stormwater slows down, it spreads out, it sinks into the earth, it's basically being dissipated by the beavers. And you know, and 30% of that water is just vanishing into the beaver complex, which, you know, is a big deal, of course, for people downstream who are worried about flooding. So that's kind of a cool thing about beavers, is that not only, you know, here in the American West, they're these great fighters of drought, and there in the rainy UK, they're actually fantastic mitigators of the opposite problem of flooding.
Hmm. I wonder if you talk a little bit about Susie Creek. You have three pictures in the book, Susie Creek, at three different snapshots. So first tell us, apparently Susie Creek is a famous example of degradation of a riparian area.
Yeah, right? Susie Creek is one of the sites that all of the beaver believers love to talk about. So that's in northeast Nevada in Elko County, and you know the story there is pretty simple. And it's a story that's very common throughout the American West, right? Is you know, you basically get many decades of overgrazing, of unmanaged grazing, you know, of ranchers basically turning the cows out into the stream bottom. The cows, you know, eat all of the riparian vegetation, the stream banks destabilize, and you end up with this sort of eroded gully, essentially, that, you know, that can't support a whole lot of life and ends up going dry in the summer. Very degraded system. And that, you know, that sort of thing has happened on hundreds of thousands of stream miles all over the American West. So the story there was, you know, was pretty straightforward. I mean, in the 1990s, the Bureau of Land Management and the ranchers who grazed that area basically agreed to, you know, some pretty simple grazing prescriptions. You know, they fenced off some parts of the creek. They agreed to, you know, keep the cows out of the stream in the summer when plants are especially vulnerable to grazing. And thanks to those very straightforward prescriptions, you know, vegetation started to regrow. They got cattails and willows coming back, and beavers, as they do, appeared almost by magic to utilize that vegetation. And thanks to those beavers and that managed grazing prescription, what had been this kind of dry, degraded gully turned into this sort of spectacular cattail marsh that was wonderful habitat and was also fantastic for the ranchers too. You know, the kind of the amazing upshot was that, you know, the ranchers in that area were initially skeptical of beavers. You know, I think that agricultural folks tend to be skeptical of beavers. But what they saw was that beavers actually created these incredible water sources for their cattle, you know, and that in the when drought struck Northeast Nevada in 2012 or so, you know, all of their neighbors had to pull their cattle off the range or truck water to their cattle. And the guys who had beavers could keep their cows out there because they, you know, they had these rodents creating this fantastic water source. So that's a pretty cool story, I think.
Just one more. I want to get into beaver politics, but one more data point here. And you know, with our audience, we're probably, you know, preaching to the choir here, but I do want to get into the politics. But this statistic is, I think this is this the Western U.S.? Anyway, I'll ask you about this. So wetlands comprise 2% of the land area and 80% of biodiversity.
Right. Yeah. And to me, that's very telling. You know, we know that in arid places, water is life, right? And that any force capable of creating water or storing water or spreading water out is immensely valuable. So, you know, we know that all kinds of creatures are congregating to these beaver created areas and wetland restoration from a biodiversity or conservation standpoint is one of the most important things we can do.
You talked about ranchers, and the ranchers are kind of often at the nexus point, right, to these politics. You talk about wolves in the book, so I want to talk about that as well. But beaver politics, areas, you know, manicured areas, controlled areas, people there would not want beavers, right? You talk about Jackson Hole, people don't want beavers on the property.
Right.
They want it a certain way, even though that's one of the attractions of living there, I would imagine.
Sure.
Right? The beautiful system. That's why the guy you talked to is relocating beavers.
Exactly, yeah.
So where are the conflict points?
Yeah, then? So, you know, as passionate a beaver believer as I am, I'm certainly not naive about what a pain in the butt these animals can be. Conflict points, I mean, one of the most common conflicts is road culverts, right? You know, you get a beaver swimming along, looking for a place to live, and, you know, the roadbed to a beaver looks like the world's greatest dam, and the culvert is the leak in the dam, right? So beavers are always trying to plug up road culverts, which often leads to roads being washed out. That's a very common beaver conflict. Of course, you've got them, you know, cutting down, you know, people's ornamental trees or orchards. That's a pretty typical one as well. Flooding people's property. So there are all kinds of issues that beavers can cause for sure. And the way that those kinds of problems are usually handled is by trapping out the offending beaver, which makes a certain intuitive logic, but is also problematic in that, you know, when you remove beavers from a road culvert, for example, you know, you're just creating a vacancy sign for the next family of beavers, right? Mm-hmm. And trapping, even though, you know, it can solve a problem temporarily, in the long term, you just end up in this sort of endless cycle of trapping and recolonization.
Tell me about, you said, I think you were either visiting or living in Paonia,
yep.
Colorado.
Right.
Tell me that story. You and your partner would take walks along the irrigation canal.
Yeah, exactly.
And irrigation ditch. Tell me that.
Yeah, that was right. So we're living in Colorado, and my then girlfriend, now wife, and I would go on these long romantic sunset walks along the irrigation ditches, and there was a beaver or two in the ditch, and we saw that beaver every night for a couple of months, and then one day the ditch rider showed up with a shotgun and, you know, took the beaver out, and I think that's a very common conflict as well, is irrigation ditches, you know, again, for a beaver, you know, an irrigation ditch is the sort of narrow, free-flowing habitat that they're looking to dam. So certainly you get lots of dams and irrigation ditches, and that's, I think that's probably at the heart of farmers and ranchers' antipathy toward beavers is that irrigation ditch conflict.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into this question. The key question is, can we coexist? And starting with, I've been referring to him as that guy, Drew Reed. I'll give him the name here. This is a guy in Jacksonville. So he relocates. He humanely traps and relocates. Can that be done on a large scale? Is that possible?
It is possible for sure, you know, and there are beaver relocation projects all over the West that have moved hundreds and hundreds of beavers. You know, Drew I think has moved close to 300 now, so you know that's one option, but you know, almost better than relocating them is taking steps that allow them to remain in place. You know, I think that's a really important thing, is sort of non-lethal conflict solving at the site, right? Because again, if you trap and relocate the beavers, you're just opening up that habitat for the next family of beavers. So, you know, the solution that I talk a lot about in the book is this thing called a flow device, which is basically this system of pipes and fences. You know, you pass the pipe through the beaver dam or through the road culvert. You know, the fences at the ends of the pipe basically prevent the beavers from plugging up the pipe. And that's a great way of sort of regulating the height of the pond. So you can say, you know, hey, I like having the beavers here. I appreciate all the great stuff they do for the environment. But, you know, I don't want my driveway underwater. And you can install one of these flow devices to basically regulate the height of that beaver pond to a level that's acceptable to both humans and animals. So, you know, many thousands of these devices have been installed all over the country. And, you know, one researcher found that they're effective 85 to 95% of the time. So that's a great way of solving these beaver conflicts and letting that beaver family stay put, do its thing, create some great ecosystem benefits.
And of course, part of the attractiveness of studying beavers is that they're representative of other species, right, as well. So when I ask the question, can we coexist with beavers, that's really a question about can we coexist with many other species.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, and I think that the species that beavers most remind me of in some ways is coyotes. Coyotes we know are playing these incredibly important roles in ecosystems, right? They're controlling rodent populations in a really important way. But you know, they also cause issues, and you know, we tend to respond to those issues by killing the offending animals. And we know, thanks to many years of peer-reviewed science, that killing coyotes is often ineffective. You know, that it doesn't reduce, you know, predation on livestock, and it can have really negative impacts in terms of sort of releasing rodent populations. So to me, you know, beavers and coyotes share a lot of sort of cultural DNA, in that they're both these kind of problematic animals that we have to learn to live with in more ecologically sensitive and sound ways.
Follow-up question. This is a kind of a silly question, but why do we have to, learn? Because, you know, we've had models before. We know we don't want to just decimate species, right? We've done that,
right?
Including with beavers,
yeah.
Right? But maybe you could expand on that. Why?
Yeah,
should we want to coexist?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there are all kinds of incredibly important reasons that we should coexist. But you know, to me, I mean, especially in the West, you know, climate change is a fantastic and very important rationale for living with beavers. We know that all over the West, right, we're losing our snowpack, right? As the climate warms, you know, that precipitation is falling as rain rather than snow. When it falls as snow, you know, it's staying on the landscape longer, and it's sort of gradually melting throughout the summer and fall. It's providing that nice sort of time release trickle that keeps our streams and irrigation ditches hydrated into the hot season. But when it falls as rain in the winter, instead it just runs off the landscape, and it's essentially lost to productive use right away. So you know, maybe there's this. I mean, we have to tackle that water storage issue somehow. And you know, maybe there's this animal that can build, you know, thousands and thousands of reservoirs up in the high country and basically capture that water and recharge aquifers and basically, you know, keep our landscapes irrigated into the hot season. So I think that rationale, that beavers are potentially this important tool of climate adaptation in a warming Western world, is a really good motivation for living with these animals.
That brings me to a question I've had in the back of my mind of scale. Yeah. We're obviously not going to get to the scale before humans arrived.
Right.
What do scientists tell us would be a good beaver population?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it's one that that differs from place to place. You know, it's here in here in Utah, researchers here at Utah State basically, modeled beaver capacity. You know, where can beavers live in Utah, and where are they living already? You know, and they found, I think, that something like between 8 and 17% of available beaver habitat was being used. So a very small proportion of where we could have these animals actually supports these animals today. Are we ever going to get back to 100% of beaver occupancy? No, probably not. And maybe that's not desirable because of the potential for conflicts. There certainly are places where beavers might be inappropriate or might cause irresolvable conflicts. But can we get back to maybe 25% or 40% of beaver occupancy? Yeah, I think that sort of thing is feasible. So I'm not sure that there's a precise, desirable target. But certainly, I think there are lots and lots of places all over this state and this country that don't support beavers today that could and should in the future.
Places like the Walmart in Logan? Well, tell me about this. I wasn't aware of this. I've been aware of beavers other places, but apparently there's a beaver colony.
Yeah.
The South Walmart.
And I think that's a fantastic example of what we can achieve. So basically the story there is that, at the South Walmart, there's a wetland adjacent to the parking lot. That wetland was colonized by beavers. And, city engineers wanted to trap the beavers out for fear that beavers would, flood the adjacent road. But instead of removing those beavers, researchers here at Utah State basically worked with the city to develop this kind of series of management steps, including those flow devices that I described earlier, these kind of pond leveling devices that regulate the height of the beaver impoundment, so that they let the beavers stay put. They took measures to sort of mitigate the potential conflicts, and again, let the beavers remain in place. And so now you've got this fantastic little pocket of really wonderful urban fish and wildlife habitat, next to a Walmart parking lot, because we figured out ways to live with these animals rather than trapping them out. So I think there's lots of potential to have these animals in pretty urban spaces.
Before we go to break, it brings up a question. I'm going to go down to the Walmart and
check it out.
So where to go and how best to, because beaver is a very attractive animal to view and to be around, but you don't want to bother them, I guess. How best to interact is the bad word. You don't don't want to interact, but to view beavers.
Yeah. So beavers, they're what scientists call crepusculars. They come out at dawn and dusk, basically, and they're really nocturnal. But you're not going to see them in the middle of the night. I would advise going down to a beaver pond right around the dusk hour, and just waiting for them to emerge to see what happens. Mm-hmm. And if you stick around and just remain still and quiet, they're pretty inquisitive animals, and sometimes they'll swim right up to you. It's pretty cool.
Okay. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get to beaver behavior. I'm fascinated. We know they build dams. We know they build lodges. I want to hear a little bit more about beaver behavior. There's a photograph in the book. Let me turn to this to get it right here. This is Half-Tailed Dale, who's awaiting a mate at the Beaver Project's Rodent Love Motel. I want to hear that story when we come back.
Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in December of 2018.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We have about 10 minutes left in the conversation. We're talking about beavers. I almost said eager there. That's the title of the book, Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. So I promised Ben Goldfarb we'd get in this last segment into beaver behavior. Maybe a good way to get into that is the anthropomorphized view of beavers. We associate words like eager, like busy,
right,
with beavers. Are beavers busy? Are they eager?
They're definitely, you know, I think that I think that what they are, rather than busy, is they're really efficient. You know, they're these really, of course, they're these amazing engineers. You know, obviously they build dams. That's kind of the classic beaver behavior. But they're also incredible canal diggers. I think that's something that people don't often give beavers credit for, is that, you know, their canals are in some ways as impressive as their dams. And you know, this, when you visit a beaver habitat, you know, one of the fun things for me is always trying to figure out, you know, what they're doing. You know, what is the purpose? Because, you know, you can have as many as a dozen dams in a single beaver complex, or even more than that. So, you know, what's this dam over here doing? What's the point of this canal here? You know, why do they want to back up water onto this part of the floodplain? You know, they're just so complex in their behaviors that it can be they're a fun animal to visit and interpret, I think.
I didn't know about the canals. So the canal systems is part of it.
Yeah, exactly. Well. You know, and the point of that is, you know, is that they, I mean, obviously, so when they're out of water, they're very vulnerable to bears and cougars and coyotes. So they, you know, they're trying to stay in the water as much as possible. So the point of the canal, of course, is that, you know, you can dig a canal over to that tasty aspen stand, you know, and then float your materials back down the canal to your main pond, which is another pretty ingenious feature, I think.
I've been curious about beaver psychology, the why of the instincts. You mentioned one. I guess that's prominent one for any animal, which is fear of predators and trying to get protection.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but I think another, you know, another big reason that beavers do why they do is that do what they do, why they do what they do, is, you know, they're almost like rotational farmers in a lot of ways. You know, they cut down a stand of willow or aspen on one side of the pond, and meanwhile, you know, they're raising the water table on the other side to basically irrigate their next crop. You know, they're sort of going back and forth within this large ecosystem they've engineered, you know, between stands of trees that they're cutting down and ones that are regrowing. So I think that beavers as rotational grazers is a pretty cool thing too.
Interesting. So they're attracted to cottonwoods, aspens.
Yeah, like willow.
They cut them down. Do they eat off of that? What's the food?
They do. Yeah. So beavers actually eat the cambium, which is the inner layer of bark of a tree. So they'll cut down an aspen or cottonwood. They'll, you know, often sort of chop it up into sections, and they'll eat the bark off of it. Eat that inner bark layer, and then they'll use those kind of peeled sticks as construction material. So, you know, when I said that they're efficient earlier, I think that's pretty cool that their food source and their building materials are one and the same.
So the beaver's love life here, I want to get into this, not being salacious, but they mate for life? What are they?
Yeah, exactly. So they mate for life. They're pretty monogamous. And a typical beaver colony or family is the adult mating pair. The kits are born in the spring, the newborns, the one-year-olds, and then the two-year-olds. And then sometime during their second year, those two-year-olds will disperse out and go look for their own territories, like teenagers heading off to college. So you'll get, you know, as many as 8 or 10 beavers sharing a single lodge in some places.
So when you're doing relocation and trying to build populations, you try to have to, you know, do things as natural as you can. But, and so this caption is, you know, it's a cute beaver. They're cute. I think we find them cute, right?
I think they're pretty cute, yeah.
Half-tailed Dale awaits a mate at the Methow Beaver Project's Rodent Love Motel.
Right. So what's going on there? So in general, when you relocate beavers, because they're these very family oriented animals, you want to capture and relocate the entire family together, right? If you move a solitary beaver, that beaver is going to go wandering around looking for a mate and probably get eaten by a cougar. You know, you want to relocate them and then have them immediately settle down and start building. When you trap beavers by themselves, which happens, you know, a lot of the beavers that you're, you know, a lot of the nuisance beavers that you live trap are going to be those two-year-old sub-adult beavers that are sort of, you know, dispersing out, looking for their own territory, and, you know, end up in an irrigation ditch or something. So when you trap those solo beavers that don't have a family attached to them, it can be really beneficial to create kind of compatible beaver pairs to operate this rodent love motel, as they put it up in the Metzow Valley in central Washington, where you're basically, you know, sort of running this sort of beaver Tinder service where, you know, you're housing males and females and trying to pair them up and create these little happy, compatible couples that you then relocate.
One other little factoid, this fellow that you went out with, Drew Reed, who does relocations, he had a kit. That's what we call the young, right?
Right.
He had a kit, and they were relocating the mother, father, I guess.
Yeah, one
probably
of the parents. It's hard to tell with beavers.
And the kit swam away.
So right.
He dashed down the stream. Only thing he could do, picked it up by the tail.
Right.
And then there was some concern you shouldn't pick it up by the tail because you could dislocate the tail.
Yeah, I've heard sort of contrary opinions from various beaver biologists about that, about whether tail dislocation is a real thing. But, you know, but in general, I would say don't hold beavers by the tail. I think that's
okay.
A good rule of thumb.
All right. Probably don't even go out and pick them up, right?
Yeah, just watch them from a safe distance, I think is a good
I want to talk briefly. We just have about 3 minutes left. I want to talk about the wolves. You have a chapter in the book about Yellowstone and how you were so affected, like thousands of others were, by a key documentary,
right,
about reintroduction of the wolves and how wolves had helped to save riparian areas and streams.
Right.
So tell me briefly about that. And then you said that that's an incomplete story. Then you go on to talk about beavers.
Absolutely, yeah. So you know, so we all kind of know the wolf story, right? The story behind Yellowstone wolves is that when wolves were extirpated from Yellowstone, you know, the elk population exploded, and they basically grazed all of the willow, aspen, and cottonwood in the park, and sort of caused streams to unravel, just like you see on cattle grazing allotments. And then when the wolves came back, you know, they basically thinned the elk herds and chased the elk out of those valley bottoms and let the vegetation regrow. And, you know, I think that you know, there's certainly a lot of scientific debate about, you know, the extent to which that's happening. But I think that, you know, one thing that all of the debates or many of the debates tend to miss is just how important beavers are in that system. You know, that when the wolves were gone and the elk exploded, beavers were one of the primary casualties, you know, because of course they basically got outcompeted for that riparian vegetation by these larger ungulate browsers. And as wolves have recovered and you know, that grazing pressure has diminished a little bit, you know, beavers have been able to come back into Yellowstone to some extent and engineer some of these habitats. You know, it's amazing, you read about what Yellowstone used to look like, and, you know, half of the northern part of the park was basically underwater thanks to beavers. It was a completely different landscape, and you know, and wolves and beavers are now working together in some ways to bring back that former wet ecosystem.
Just a minute left. You talked to Mary O'Brien down in southern Utah.
Right.
I think we think of beavers as being in wetter areas like Cache Valley, if we think of Utah. But Moab area, you know, drier, more arid.
Mm-hmm.
Beavers are in those places too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and again, I think that a lot of the places that we consider arid today were actually, you know, substantially wetter thanks to beavers. And there, you know, Mary and I visited Mill Creek down in Moab, which is, you know, this kind of this very dry looking slot canyon, basically, that, you know, that had a dozen beaver dams in it. So it's pretty cool to see these animals flourishing in this essentially desert environment.
What's your 30-second takeaway? We spent the hours on beavers.
Yeah.
You wrote a whole book on beavers. You're going to give a presentation today. What's your elevator pitch?
Yeah, you know, I think that as you said earlier, you know, we humans are sort of these fanatical micromanagers, right? We you know, we love to sort of rule the world in this, you know, in this godlike way. But in the case of beavers, you know, there's this other animal that shapes landscapes in the same ways that we do. And by letting that animal do what it does, you know, we can actually achieve all of these ecological benefits. You know, as scientists here at Utah State are fond of saying, let the rodent do the work, you know, get out of the way and let beavers help us because they want to.
That's a good place to end the program. The book is Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. Ben Goldfarb, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.